Professor Yaron Zilberberg, and to be honest, I feel a bit of a stranger here in this conference, and not because I came from Israel, but because, as you can see from the title of my group, I come from the ultra-fast optics group, which has nothing to do with quantum mechanics. So why did I bother to do all the way up to Waterloo? Well, the reason is that in the last couple of years, we have demonstrated several experimental works where we took some techniques and ideas very common in the ultra-fast optics world and implemented them in quantum optics experiments. And in the next 20 minutes, I'm going to show you one of these ideas, which is called pulse shaping. So first, I must explain what do I mean by classical pulse shaping. So imagine I have a short pulse. And when I mean short, I mean on a scale of femtoseconds. So femtosecond is like 10 to the minus 15. So it's very short. And suppose I want to tailor its temporal profile. So since it's so short, it's hard. I cannot just use electronics to do that. So again, I remind you, it's a classical pulse. Typically, it has like 10 to the 10 photons every pulse. So I don't need to know anything about quantum mechanics. It's all pure classical optics, 19th century optics. And I want to shape its profile. So the way to do it is I take the pulse and I send it to a grating. Now, what the grating does, it reflects each spectral component of the pulse to a slightly different direction. Then I could put a lens, which all it does, it just collimates the beam. So instead of the frequencies propagating in different angles, they'll now all propagate in the same direction. But when I look at over here, I get all the spectral components spread along this axis. Okay, that's why I call it the spectral plane. Now, if I don't do anything and just let these spectral components pass through another set of lens and grating, I'll just wrap all the frequencies back again and retain back the same short pulse. But now, imagine I put in some optical components along that spectral plane. And over here, what I'm putting is what we call a special light modulator, which is simply an array of liquid crystal cells, just like in every LCD display. And the idea is that we can approach the voltage we apply to every cell individually, and in that way, play with the optical properties of each cell. So we can change, and since we are putting it along the spectral plane, we can change the optical properties that each frequency sees individually. And in that way, we can control the phase. We can also control the polarization or even attenuate some of the frequencies. And that's a very easy way. And you see, after I wrap all the frequencies back, I get a distorted pulse. But it's not really distorted. I can shape it. I can tailor it exactly the way I want. So like I mentioned, this is all classical optics. And what we ask ourselves is, can we apply the same technique in the single photon regime? Can we shape the wave function of a single photon? So to be honest, at the beginning, we weren't quite sure what does it mean to shape a single photon. And I hope that in this talk, I will try to explain what do we mean by shaping a photon. And the second thing I want to talk about is, what is it good for? And this is actually the reason I'm here. Our feeling is that we have a pretty cool tool to implement for quantum optics, but we didn't come up yet with a nice protocol or a nice scheme for quantum information or quantum computation. And then I'll be really glad to get some feedback from you guys. Maybe we could work up on some kind of a scheme. Okay, so how do we do it in the single photon regime? First, we need to generate single photons. And we do that, like we heard several times in this conference, using the spontaneous parametric down conversion. So the idea, once again, is you have a nonlinear interaction, and you shine it with a very strong laser beam, what we call a pump. And due to the nonlinear interactions inside a crystal, every now and then I have some kind of probability that one of the pump photons will spontaneously split into two lower frequency photons, what we call the signal and idler. Now, this process should conserve both energy, which means that the sum of the frequencies of the signal and idler should be equal to the frequency of the pump photon, and it should also conserve momentum, or what we call in optics phase matching. Now let's consider the case where my pump is monochromatic. It has a well-defined single frequency. In that case, like we said, from energy conservation, it means that the sum of the frequencies of the signal and the idler should be exactly omega p. But as you can see from this cartoon, what is omega signal and omega idler by itself, I cannot know. Every one of these combinations will give me a sum of omega p. So in principle, the bandwidth of the signal and idler photons could be extremely wide. And specifically, it means that we don't know what is the difference between the frequencies. All we know is that the sum is exactly omega p. And this is what people call time-energy entanglement or frequency entanglement. Because if I just measure the frequency of the signal or the idler, I have no idea what the result will be. But once I measure the frequency for the signal, I know exactly what is the frequency of the idler. And this is entanglement, and we could write that in, you know, explicitly as a superposition of pairs of photons. And you see the sum of photon with omega p divided by 2 minus omega, and one with omega p divided by 2 plus omega. So the sum is omega p, but I have an integral over omega, so I don't know what is the frequency of each. Okay, so I'll show you in the experimental results. I'll get to that in a minute. And what is the bandwidth of these photons? Well, that depends on the parameters of the crystal, temperature, orientation, and these are all stuff I can tweak in the lab. So it's pretty cool. I can control it quite nicely. Okay, so what does it mean in the time domain? This was all, that picture I showed you was in the frequency domain. And in the time domain, we know from uncertainty relation that if I know the sum of the frequencies, it means I don't know the sum of the time. And what it means in the lab, I don't know what is the arrival time. When will these photons be created? But I do know the difference in time, which means I do know they are always created. If the bandwidth is large, it means they are always created together. Okay, so if this cartoon of the wave function in the time domain, you see that along this axis, it's quite spread. Typical like time scales, it's 10 to minus 7 set, but it's very localized along the time difference axis. And you see it's, for the parameters of our experiment, it was 7 orders of magnitude difference. So what does it mean in real life? Well, the most naive way to think about it is, suppose I put a detector for the signal and a detector for the idler. Now, the fact that I don't know the sum of the time means that I have no idea when will I get a click on either the signal or either detectors. All I do know is once I get a click for the signal, I immediately afterwards will get a click for the idler, or the other way around. So it's the time difference between these two detectors that behaves like a femtosecond pulse. And if I gate one detector to the other, I'll get some short pulse with a femtosecond resolution. Now, that partly answers your question, because if it wasn't a coherent sum, I wouldn't get this femtosecond resolution. The fact that all the frequency components add up coherently tells me it's a coherent process. But OK, so this is a nice way to think about it. The only problem is, OK, so sorry, once before. So now the thing we are trying to do is, we want to take that pulse shaper I presented at the beginning and put it only on the idler arm and see if I can shape the two-photon correlation function. Because we said it behaves like a femtosecond pulse, so can we also shape it like we do for a femtosecond pulse? So this is all a nice way to think about it. The only problem is it will never work because I cannot see femtosecond resolution with detector. Electronics, the best it could do is a nanosecond resolution. State-of-the-art detectors maybe could bring me to 100 picosecond. I'm talking about something with 6 orders of magnitude faster. So there was no way to see these time correlations just like that. So the solution came something like actually exactly 20 years ago. And in this experiment done by 3 people, Hong, Au, and Mandel. And many people consider this to be the most elegant experiment in quantum optics, so I'll spend now a few minutes to explain what they've done. And the idea is that instead of just sending your two photons directly to two detectors, you put a beam splitter before. Okay? And now what does the beam splitter do? So let's first think about it classically. So classically, if I send a pulse of light to a beam splitter, and it's a symmetrical beam splitter, it means that half of the light will be reflected and half will be transmitted. And if I look at the transformation of the field, that's what I see. I see that half is reflected, half is transmitted, but the reflected part gains a pi over 2 phase. So this is just a property of lossless beam splitters. Now in the quantum regime, suppose I send one photon, exactly one photon. Now the whole essence of quantum mechanics is that that quantum of energy cannot split. So after the beam splitter, I have a superposition of possibility that either the photon is transmitted or it is reflected. And this superposition, again, will have this pi over 2 phase, exactly like in the classical case. And this pi over 2 phase will become very important, as we'll soon see. Okay, so this was for one photon entering the beam splitter. Now let's try to understand what happens when I have two photons, from the one from above and one from the bottom. So basically, I can have four possibilities, right? I can either one is reflected and the other transmitted, or transmitted reflected, and I have two possibilities that either both of them are transmitted or both of them are reflected. Now we'll concentrate in this experiment on these two cases, what we call a coincidence case, where we get one photon at each detector. Okay, this is what we call coincidence, obviously, and we see that there are two paths that lead to this final state. Now we know from like a Feynman-like argument that if we have a final state and two indistinguishable paths that lead to exactly the same state, then these two paths will interfere. And therefore we should add the amplitude for these paths and not the probabilities. Now remember that pi over 2 that we talked about on each reflection. Now we have two reflections, one for each photon, and therefore I'll have a pi phase shift between this path and this path, and therefore when I sum it up, I'll get no coincidence events. So this is what people call the Hongao-Mandel effect. Now, an important issue is that these two paths will be indistinguishable. Once they are distinguishable, I won't have this interference effect, and the easiest way to introduce some kind of distinguishability between them is just by applying a delay between the two photons. Then, in principle, I could know that the first photon came from this path and the second photon from this path. They are no longer indistinguishable, therefore I won't have an interference, and I'll retain back that 50% chance to get a coincidence. So these three guys actually did the experiment in 87. So this is, again, a scheme of their experiment. And what they've done, they're just mechanically scanned the position of the beam splitter and therefore introduced a delay between the signal and the either. And these are the results. So you can see that when the beam splitter was exactly centered, they got no coincidence. So here is the coincidence as a function of the position of the beam splitter. But once the beam splitter was moved far enough, they retained back the 50% coincidences 50% chance to get a coincidence. Now, what we want to do, and an important thing, this here it's in microns, but when you translate it to just divide by the speed of light, you see that the time resolution here is hundreds of femtoseconds. So they call their paper sub-picosecond time intervals. And nowadays, you can get to 10 femtosecond resolution easily. So what we want to do in our experiment is just put a pulse shaper on the signal path and see if we can shape this Hongao-Mandel deep. Okay, so this is the experimental setup we have built. Now I don't want to get into details, so you'll have to trust me here a bit. We did the Hongao-Mandel in the polarization version. So instead of having two spatial modes, two different directions that the signal and idler propagate to, we'll have two different polarizations. Therefore we prepare our photons in a superposition of X and Y polarizations, where X and Y are the plus 45 and minus 45 degrees of polarization. And we send them, instead of sending them to a regular beam splitter, this is a polarization beam splitter, which reflects all the vertical photons and transmits all the horizontal photons. So when a plus 45 photon arrives, it has, again, a 50% to be reflected and a 50% to be transmitted, exactly like in the Hongao-Mandel configuration. So this is just Hongao-Mandel in in polarization. But now I want to somehow, you see, the nice thing about it is that the two photons propagate in the same direction, so it's kind of easily to manipulate. But the problem is, how can I introduce a delay between them if they propagate in the same direction? So here I'm going to use a very nice property of Fourier transforms that I'm sure you're all familiar of. Suppose I have a function f of t. So its Fourier transform is capital F of omega. And now I'm asking myself, what is f of t plus some kind of delay? Well, it's just taking the Fourier of f and multiplying it by a phase function. And this phase that I need to multiply by is a linear function in the frequency domain, right? So now all I need to do in order to introduce a delay is put my pulse shaper in the path of the two beams. And remember, I can apply any phase function I want to these photons. So all I need to do is apply a linear phase function, which its slope will be exactly the delay between the two photons. You see, the slope of this of omega is tau. So this is what we have done. And over here on the right, you can see the spectrum of the two photons, and on top of it, the phase function that we applied. So in this case, it's a linear phase function. And we just started scanning the slope of this function. And here is the experimental results. So you see that we retain the Hong-Gaumann-Del beam. Each point here is a coincidence measurement, which corresponds to a certain slope that we applied in the linear phase function. So you see nicely we retain the deep, and it goes almost totally to zero. This has a very nice visibility of 90%. So this is the Hong-Gaumann-Del deep. This is exactly what they have done 20 years ago, and now we want to shape it. How we'll shape it, we'll just add, in addition to this linear phase function, we'll start adding all kinds of phase functions. So here are several examples. So when we just apply a pi step, like here, we reverse the deep. So instead of having a deep, we got a peak. If you put, again, a step, but only a pi over 2, then we change the deep front beam symmetric. It's now anti-symmetric. And it's pretty cool. We can really change. Here's a train of a square train of pulses. So we have several peaks. And it's very easy to manipulate and tailor the shape of the deep exactly as you want it. And the red is the theoretical line. No fitting parameters, or the parameters are measured from the experiment. OK, so I hope that I convinced you that we have a pretty cool way to control the photons. And now let's try to answer, what is it good for? So the first thing we demonstrated is that we can use this pulse shaper for generating a Bellstedt synthesizer. So I don't have too much time to get into it. I'll just browse fastly through what are Bellstedts. So if I have two qubits, they span a four-dimensional space, and which is spanned by the four Bellstedts that you probably all know, the phi states and the psi states. Now, traditionally, I have two qubits, but I need some other quantum number on top of the polarization to distinguish between these two qubits, right? What here I marked it as red and blue. And traditionally, these are two different spatial modes. Okay, you send one qubit to the left, the other qubit to the right. There's also the time beam modes that Yasama and Josh talked about. And here we present a new way to distinguish the two qubits by their spectrum. So suppose I decide that all the red-tuned photons are one mode and all the blue-tuned photons are the other mode. So in that way, I can easily generate collinear stream of Bellstedts, and I could build a Bellstedt synthesizer because I can, just by changing a knob on my computer, I can move from all these Bellstedts. And the crucial point is, changing in between the phi is easy. All I need to change is the phase between the vertically the vertical polarization and horizontal polarization. That you can do just with one liquid crystal cell and connected to the computer. The crucial point is moving between the phi and the psi, because you see, I need to rotate the polarization, but only of the blue-detuned photons. And for that, I need a pulse shaper. And here is the experimental results where we proved that indeed we generated a Bell state. I won't get into the detail, just maybe we'll focus on the Psi state. The one important property of the Psi minus state, a singlet state, is that it's immune for rotation. Martin mentioned that yesterday. So what we demonstrate here, we just rotated the polarization of the Psi state, and we measured the coincidence for having both polarization, both photons at the same polarization. These are the red triangulars. And you see that it never happens for the Psi state. But, and what we get is that it's always in orthogonal polarization. These are the black circles. And the other way goes for the phi and the expected fringes for the phi minus and psi plus. Okay, so I showed you that we can generate a polarization, a Bell state polarization synthesizer. It's pretty cool because it's computer controlled. I have four knobs on my computer and I just press psi minus, psi plus, I get whatever I want. It's robust, first of all, because it's collinear, so it's much easier to control. But also, the singlet state is decoherent, it's a decoherence-free subspace, like we heard yesterday. And that's very important when you want to couple your Bell states to optical fibers, because I don't know how much of you know, but it's pretty hard to maintain polarization in optical fibers. Once you generate a singlet and you can couple it to the same fiber, then they all will always, the two photons will always undergo the same rotations, and therefore you will always get a singlet. It's easier to couple. You can generate high flux like this. I won't get into that. Another nice thing that you can, protocol that you can think of is multiplexing. We generated all the wavelengths in the same Bell state. But you can think of generating, let's say, one half of the spectrum in a psi minus state and the other half in a phi plus state. And of course, divide the spectrum to even more parts. And then if you just look on your output, it looks like a mixture of Bell states, but it is actually composed of a coherent sum of Bell states. And it also opens research in the field of can we generate like this multidimensional qubits, but I don't have time to talk about that. So if you want to take just one home message, what I try to convince you is that we have a cool tool to play with in quantum information. And we hope to come up with some more protocols that we can implement them for. Thank you very much.
Questions? Your Mendel experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. So, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it's just because if you look at the spectrum, if I would have had a nice Gaussian tails, it wouldn't have wiggled. But typically, a down-converted light gives a sink, a spectrum of a sink, and it has these tails that you see over here. This is, again, this is a spectrum. It's a measured spectrum. And these tails are the ones that give you that these fringes. If you have a continuous tail, the exponential tail, you won't get them. Ava? Mm-hmm. Yes, so of course, so one way, you have dispersion compensating fibers, so you can use that. Or you can pre-compensate for the dispersion you can build up a pulse compressor. It's basically a set of prisms with which you can apply negative dispersion. So you can pre-compensate for dispersion effects and then couple into the fiber. Of course, whenever you use broad bandwidth of light, you have to worry about dispersion. But there are techniques, again, techniques that come from the short pulses community that also apply for quantum optics.
That's a question I have. Your whole shape of the sort of spatial, you
Yeah, so basically what limits the resolution is the how much diffraction you get from the grating and the resolution of the pixels in your SLM. So you're right, it's more or less on the scale of nanometers. The technology of the LCDs and all those special light modulators keeps on increasing, but it's still very expensive. Like one array like this can cost like $20,000. So we are limiting ourselves to not, that's why you see all the phase functions we applied weren't too complicated. So we won't need a crazy resolution. And also to get a good grating is also can cost a lot. So yeah, but it's nanometers. Yes. Why do you want to control pulses? That's okay. So there are many applications for it. One of them is coherent control of chemical processes. Suppose you have some kind of molecule, and you want to dissociate, but a certain bond. And you know that that bond, the coupling of that bond is stronger to a certain polarization. Now, with the pulse shaping, you can change the polarization of the pulse along the pulse within the femtosecond timescales. So people actually demonstrated how you can control certain chemical processes with coherent control. So that's one example. People always also use it for two-photon absorption to show that you can, suppose you have an atom and you shine it with a transition, say, at 400 nanometers, and you shine it with a laser pulse at 800 nanometers. So basically, you have a certain probability to have a two-photon absorption. The two photons of your pulse will excite the atom. Now, if you apply a pi step, exactly like we applied here, then you'll have destructive interference, some kind of destructive interference, I won't get into the details, which annihilates totally that two-photon absorption process. So there are many applications for that. Thank you.